You're listening to a previously recorded Gulf Coast Live.
This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. It's been 3 years since journalist Jason Rezaian was released from an Iranian prison where he was jailed for alleged espionage. Now, in a new memoir, he recounts the experience of the 544 days that he spent in the notorious Evin prison. It's called Prisoner and offers insight not only to his experiences while incarcerated, it brings a greater understanding of a country that most Americans understand little about. He's in Southwest Florida for an event with the Naples Council on World Affairs and managed to carve out a little time to come in and visit us in our studio today. Jason Rezaian, I'm so glad you could come in.
Great to be here, Julie. Thanks for having me on.
This part of our show is taped in advance, so we can't take any calls, but I do welcome our listeners to offer feedback and comments through our social media. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So tell me about your life in Iran before this arrest. You were working there as a journalist for The Washington Post?
Yes. So I'd grown up in the San Francisco Bay Area. My father came from Iran. My mom was from Illinois. And as the years went on, my dad's extended family, many members of it, decided to move to California. So we had this large, mostly Iranian family living in the Bay Area. So I was always attracted to the culture and the traditions of it. And in 2001, when I was 25, I had the chance for the first time to actually go to Iran. I just graduated from college. I wanted to be a journalist, and I knew that if I could go to Iran consistently, that I could probably work from there. So it was many trips between 2001 and 2009 until I decided that, you know what, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to try and base myself there for an indefinite period of time. And that's what happened. I moved there in the spring of 2009. And from then until the day that I was arrested in the summer of 2014, it was an incredible place to live and work. Not easy, not good in every way, but exciting and fascinating, inspiring.
Well, journalists always love a challenge.
Oh, yeah, of course. And, I met my wife there. And so, that just really rooted me in the place.
Well, I start thinking about, now I want a visual. You know, it's not going to be a white picket fence, different colored houses along a nice manicured road. What was your living situation like?
So in Tehran, it's one of the biggest cities in the world. They estimate the population to be about 14 million people. And that swells to probably 20 during the day when people commute to work. So it's big and busy, and there's a lot of cars and congestion and pollution and all these sorts of things that are, not beautiful. But in between all of that, there is all sorts of little remnants of the past to be found, whether it's a ruin of a old building from hundreds of years ago or a dam that was built 200 years ago, just flashes of the past. It's a concrete city with massive high-rise buildings and apartment towers. But then when you leave Tehran, you have these cities that are essentially intact historical gems, some of them dating back thousands of years. Some of the oldest inhabited cities of the world.
It sounds like a beautiful place to just be. And there you were, just being, doing your job, living the dream.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the garage one day. What happened?
There was a man standing at the elevator door with a gun pointed right at me. And he and two others worked their way into the elevator, took my wife and I back up to our apartment, began ransacking the place. Looking for, we had no idea what, and they made us relinquish the passwords to our phones and our computers. They took our devices. They took all of our identity, forms of identification, passports, driver's license, birth certificates, ID cards. And after a couple of hours, they hauled us off to Evin prison. They blindfolded us, handcuffed me. And separated me from my wife, and I didn't hear from her for a very long time.
At this point, did you know who these people were? They were plainclothes, right?
Plainclothes. So I had no idea. I did know that, from the experiences of journalists and other dual nationals in the past, that that members of the security services, the intelligence ministry, often pick people up and either rough them up, question them, sometimes imprison them, usually for short periods of time. But you know, in that first, in those first hours, it's very confusing, and you want to assume that this ordeal is going to end very quickly.
Well, it's got to feel like, and I'm imagining from where I'm standing, that sounds like such a violation.
Just yeah.
taking you into your stuff, getting your passwords, looking through all your things and throwing things around your apartment or your home. It seems very foreign and strange to imagine that happening here.
Yeah.
Did it seem as strange being there?
It was something that in the 5 years of living there, although, you know, as a journalist, I'd been questioned more than once and I'd been asked to appear in various government offices by officials who didn't identify who or for what organization they worked. Yeah, I mean, this was something completely out of the norm for me. And I think for my wife, Yegi, she realized very quickly that, you know, this is bad. Whatever this is, it's very bad.
Well, eventually it came to be known that this is the Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Yes.
A group over which there's not a whole lot of accountability or oversight.
Almost none.
Did that make you even more scared?
Yeah, but I didn't know that for, you know, the first 6 weeks.
Oh, wow, 6 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I just assumed I was being held by the Ministry of Intelligence, and there is some accountability over them. But when it comes to the intelligence wing of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, there's none. They don't have to answer to anybody. And the section of the prison, I liken it to, you know, we hear about these black ops sites where foreign nationals are detained sometimes here in the United States or in allied countries where there's nobody overseeing what goes on in these places. It was like that.
Yeah, and I was reading up on it a little bit. It's where a lot of intellectuals go.
Yes.
And yeah. So they called it the university.
Yeah, but you know, the section of the prison that I was in is cut off from everyone else. So we are in full isolation. You're either in solitary confinement or you're with one or two other cellmates. The entire time that I was there, I had two cellmates. I never interacted with another prisoner in that year and a half.
Who are these two cellmates? Did you know them from before?
No. One was Iranian. He was a Kurd and Sunni, which in the politics of contemporary Iran is two strikes against you. And he was basically being shaken down. He was a wealthy entrepreneur and factory owner, and the IRGC saw an opportunity to try and you know, buy his business at a cut rate price, and he refused. The other, who I spent a lot of time with, was from the Republic of Azerbaijan, which is Iran's neighbor to the north, and he was also being accused of espionage, and all he was a importer and exporter of, you know, consumer goods like diapers and chocolate. A wonderful guy who I ended up spending 13 months with. We didn't share a language when we started because I don't speak Azeri or Russian. You know, Azerbaijan was a former Soviet state, so everybody there that's of a certain age speaks Russian. And he didn't speak any English or Farsi. So our communications, especially in the beginning, were very difficult. But, you know, when you're thrust into a situation where 24 hours a day you're with one person, you figure it out.
Yeah, pointing and gestures help, at least in person.
Yeah, right? Lots of that. Lots of that.
So you're put in prison with no real explanation. You're forced to endure interrogations.
Yeah.
When did that start?
That started almost immediately. I think that first night when we were hauled in, I was still blindfolded, and before I was processed and put in prison clothes, I was taken to a room blindfolded, and the questions began. That, you know, you are you're the head of the CIA station, and we know this because of your relationships with Secretary John Kerry, Secretary of State John Kerry, and President Obama. Which obviously I had no relationships with these people, but you know, it's just a constant hurling of innuendo and slurs against you that you're unable to defend against. And, you know, my Farsi is competent. It's better now than it was at that moment because I've spent a lot of time since living completely in that language. But blindfolded and confused and, you know, recently separated by force from my wife, I had no idea what was going on.
That had to be so scary. You're afraid of making a misstep with the language too.
Exactly. So I just said, I haven't done anything wrong. People are making a mistake. You know, consult with whatever other authorities there are to consult with. You'll realize very quickly that this is all just a big mix-up. But then, you know, as time goes on, you begin to realize, no, this is not a mix-up. And no, they don't think that you've actually done anything wrong. This is a pretext and a concocted story that's going to be used for political purposes.
And they're just out there fishing, trying to find something to.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, they spent a year trying to find something that they could pin on me, and they couldn't, you know?
But I know that it was frightening, but the things that they were saying seemed so Keystone Cops.
Yeah, they certainly were. But the frightening aspect of it is that you have nowhere to go. You have no ability to communicate with anybody beyond the walls of the prison. You know that there are people that are being executed in that very same prison.
You were threatened with that frequently.
In the first several months, almost daily. And, you know, I was in solitary confinement as well. So you come to a place where you don't know what to believe. And all you can do is try and keep some semblance of humanity and keep yourself to the best of your ability rooted in reality. And the reality was I hadn't done anything wrong.
Yeah, but the reality was also you were stuck in a cell with four walls and a fluorescent light that never turned off.
Right. And one more reality of that was I had no choice about it. So, you know, the only choices that you have are how you're going to deal with those circumstances. In the quiet hours of the night, sometimes a neighboring cell, you know, you would hear screams coming from them, pleas to be released. And I didn't do anything and, you know, pounding on the wall. And I realize that that's not a recipe for success. You know, the recipe for success is to stay as calm as possible, do what you're told, and try to come up with a routine on how you're going to get through this time.
But you also don't want to come across either to your interrogators as smug or laughing at them either too, right?
Not in the beginning.
After a while, you're like
– You know, after a while, I became very, very clear in my – disdain and they knew where I stood.
You had it.
Yeah.
Right. So your wife had been arrested at the same time. You mentioned that. When did you ever get any information about her?
The first 35 days, absolutely nothing. And then on that 35th day, my interrogator told me that that I would be allowed to see her very briefly. And they brought her into the room and she was blindfolded, and they, you know, let her remove her blindfold, and there I was, a shadow of my former self. I'd lost a considerable amount of weight. I was gaunt and pale, unshaven. I was in a bad way.
What did she look like?
She's always beautiful, but she looked scared. She'd lost weight, but we were both very. It's a strange thing to say, but we're both very happy, right? You know, from the depths of where we'd been to have this moment of recognition that the other was alive and intact. I write in the book that it was probably the happiest moment of my life, considering, you know, where I'd come from. And then I was thrust back into solitary confinement. And I realized then that if there was going to be little shots of exposure to my wife, that would make all the difference in maintaining my sanity and my ability to push through.
Did you lose track of the passage of days?
Never. In solitary, you know, as you imagine, you're notching them all on the wall however you can. And when I got out of that solitary, my Azeri cellmate was the first one that I had. He had been in 10 days longer than me, which we established on that first night that we were together. So anytime I wondered about how many days we'd been in, I asked him how many days you've been in, and I just subtract 10.
Your calculator.
Yeah.
Have you kept up with the two people that
Unfortunately, the Kurdish man is still in prison, and I don't have any information about him. But the Azeri one has been released, was released about 2 months after me. We haven't seen each other yet, but we Skype sometimes. He's got two nieces who speak pretty fluent English, and they act as translators for us. He sends me letters, and it's a really kind of lovely thing to know that we both survived this and think incredibly highly of the other. And I'm looking forward, hopefully in 2019, to a rendezvous somewhere.
That would be great. So I want to ask, how did you view Tehran while you were living there before your arrest?
Yeah.
And how do you view it now after your arrest?
Look, I think I loved living there. It was exciting. It was energizing, frustrating, but rich. I mean, the experience of living there was extremely rich. I miss that. I miss it every day. I don't miss the pollution. I can breathe better now. I don't miss the traffic. I can get most places more quickly. And I guess I don't miss the uncertainty, right? I mean, the anxiety, the anxiousness of not knowing if you're in trouble or you're not in trouble, right?
And I'm wondering if that's a journalist feeling or if that's everybody feeling. Because from the outside, the point of view of someone who's never been anywhere in the Middle East,
yeah.
Tehran could be seen as a place of fearful and paranoid order or lively but lawless place where people are always just kind of taking their chances.
I think it's more of the latter, unless you're unless you have a reason to believe that you're under direct threat for something. I think in the past it was probably a more fearful place than it is now. But the tides are turning, and as the ideological fervor of the 1979 revolution begins to wear off and you get farther and farther from that moment, people are more prepared to flout those rules and take the consequences, you know, at a time when, you know, 40 years into this. In all the years that I was there, women would not dare to take off their head covering in public, right? And people opined about what would happen if all women just took it off one day, right? Now more and more women are going out in public without it, and in most cases, nothing's happening, right? They might be reprimanded. They might be told to put it back on. Some have been arrested. But the vast majority of times that a woman is walking down the street with no scarf, nothing happens.
The world did not end.
The world didn't end.
Yeah.
The world didn't end, and a new revolution didn't happen, you know, and there wasn't a major crackdown and bloodletting. So I think that that's a sign that not necessarily that the regime is weak, but the ideology has been diluted and the defenders of it have been defeated.
I want to ask, and it's kind of in generalizations, can you describe maybe the perception of the average citizen of Tehran of American citizens?
Yeah.
What do they think of Americans, not as a political entity but as individuals?
Well, so I've had the opportunity to be an American in Tehran and an American all around Iran and in other countries. And I've had the opportunity to lead other Americans around Iran and Tehran. And I would say that my experience and the experience of others, including members of the World Affairs Council groups who I've spoken with when they visited Iran, was one of surprising hospitality, you know, a very welcoming approach to Americans. You know, when you're seen – recognized as a foreigner, people don't ask you, you know, are you a foreigner? They know you're a foreigner. They ask you, are you American? You know, they don't ask you, are you European? Are you Canadian? Are you Australian? They want to know if you're American. There is an intense bond between the people of Iran and the United States going back 60 years. There was a time in the 1960s and 70s when more foreign students in – there were more of the foreign students studying in American universities, more came from Iran than any other country. And so there would – and the number of Iranians living in the United States is higher than the number of Iranians living in any other country in the world. So there's a natural connection. And I think that the perception of Iranians towards the United States of America, its people, and for most part the government has always been actually pretty positive despite everything that you see at Friday prayers and the burning of flags and death to America and all this sort of stuff. That's the exception, not the norm.
And unfortunately, in news reporting, the exception is what's reported on. So that ends up being filtered as what Americans see. So what would you like Americans to know about Iranian people?
I tried very hard in all the years that I was working there to tell the stories of Iranian people rather than the narrative of the Iranian government. And, you know, I think – my hope has always been that we would see that nation for what it is, which is an educated population of people who belong to a culture that can trace its roots back thousands of years, that have been the vanguards of progress and innovation and art and culture at various times in their history and aren't right now. But that have something very unique to offer to the world. And they're being impeded in that by their own government and by the government of the United States of America. And I'm saddened by that. So I wanted to just give them a platform, an opportunity to talk about their fears, hopes, aspirations, and just give a window into that country. I was one reporter working for the Washington Post. There were a handful of other reporters. Each of us is covering a country of 80 million people. That's a very tall order, right? You think about the staffs that exist in other countries of importance, right? I mean, you know, you go to Lebanon, right, which is considered another very important country in the Middle East. It's a tiny country, and there are hundreds of reporters there from all around the world. I can count the number of Western reporters in Tehran on two hands.
Yeah, I can't imagine the visas are real easy to get a hold of there, though, either.
Not at all. So it's not, you know, I don't blame this on the U.S. I don't blame it on the government of Iran. Well, I do kind of blame it on the government of Iran. But, you know, the fact is the circumstances are such that this country has been out of view of the average American or Western person for the last 40 years. And I saw an opportunity to open a window and shed some light on that place. And that's all I was ever trying to do.
Kind of like a daily life story.
Yeah. I mean, look, if you string together the hundreds of stories I wrote from Iran, you will see a patchwork of what this country is like.
Next book. All
perhaps.
The stories together.
Yeah, sure.
So right – are you still suing the government of Iran? Right now,
yeah,
are you still in
yeah.
there? Tell me about that lawsuit. Where did it come from? Why? And what do you hope for it to achieve?
So, you know, I have the opportunity in suing Iran to have an official narrative and decision that that is based on a fair judicial process. In Iran, I was put on trial. I was not allowed to really defend myself. I was not given counsel. There was no evidence or witnesses in the trial against me. And that's the official version of events so far. I've written a book which is a narrative of those events, and anybody can either accept or refute those. In suing Iran in American courts, I had the opportunity in an actual legal framework, an accepted, internationally accepted framework, to make a complaint about the abuses that government perpetrated against me and my family. And in doing so, I testified. I gave testimony about my experiences. My mother and my brother did as well. We had expert witnesses to talk about Iran's habit of taking hostages, a medical expert who sort of gave testimony about my physical and mental well-being after this experience, and a financial expert who gave testimony about how this would cost me, what damage it would do to me financially to have been imprisoned in Iran. So that's what that was. And, you know, I had an opportunity to seek justice in a way that I didn't have an opportunity to in Iran, and I'd be a fool not to do that because this will stand for the for all time.
Could something like this lawsuit be a deterrent from them continuing this type of practice?
That's my hope. You know, there's a personal component to this of wanting justice for my family and me, and then there's the deterrent component that, you know, I don't want this to happen to anybody else. And frankly, it's happened to several other American families since my release, and it's still happening.
Yeah, well, one person, Nazanin Zaghari Radcliffe.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about her story. She's still in jail?
She's still in jail as of April 3rd of this year. She's been in prison for 3 years. She was taken just about 3 months after my release. She's a dual British-Iranian national who was in Iran visiting her family with her 2-year-old daughter, Gabriella, when she was arrested at the airport on their way home to London. She's an aid worker for the Thomson Reuters Foundation. Has nothing to do with anything related to Iran, but was arrested on charges that she was seeking to overthrow the Islamic Republic. She'd been separated from her daughter, Gabriella, this entire time, and from her husband, Richard, who's a British national living in London. Richard hasn't seen either his daughter or his wife in over 3 years. I've written about that case extensively. I've written about all of these cases of dual nationals, foreign nationals held in Iran whenever I can. But that one in particular is really galling because the destruction of a family, the separation of a toddler from her parents over nothing, over perceived political value of her mother. It's nauseating.
But what political value is it? Because when this happened to you, it was in the middle of the negotiations over nuclear arms. I don't understand, and maybe there is no benefit, but I don't get how the government benefits from holding these people.
Well, the belief is that they will get something from the other government.
Like a bargaining chip of some sort,
yeah.
Right?
And you know, the Iranian government claims a debt from the British government on a arms sale that was never fulfilled, in hundreds of millions of dollars that they prepaid supposedly on a contract that was never delivered on, and this family is paying the price because of that. Now, you know, whether or not Iran's claim against the UK has merit is irrelevant to the fact that, you know, normal people are not supposed to be put in these situations to pay these prices. It's dehumanizing, and it sets terrible precedents that, you know, the nationals of the United States or any of our allied Western allies can't go places anymore because they're under threat of being swooped up off the street, put in a holding pen, and kept there until the responsible government concedes to Iran or another country, because other countries are now doing this, to get what they want.
It's definitely not good for tourism.
No, no. It's not good for a lot of things.
It's not good for – I feel so bad for family. You famously said to the late Anthony Bourdain once that you both loved and hated Iran. And your memoir is being published by Anthony Bourdain Books. I want to know, what was the experience like sharing Iran with someone like that on parts unknown?
It was incredible. It was in many ways a dream come true, in the sense that I, like millions of other people, were was a fan of his work for many years, but also knew that his coming to Iran mattered, and that it would be seen differently after he had left his mark by doing an episode about it. So to have the opportunity to be a part of that is something that means, you know, an incredible amount to my wife and I. And I think that, you know, that what the quote that you just read back perfectly encapsulates that. You know, I'm so thrilled that I was asked to be a part of this. But, you know, our experience is the height of why my relationship and many people's relationship with Iran is a bittersweet one. And I think that of all of the things that I've been involved with, and all of the people that were advocates for me while I was in trouble and have been friends and mentors to me since, it was Anthony Bourdain that really touched my wife and I the most. And, you know, the loss of him in our lives and in the kind of collective humanity, it's something that we can't calculate in words.
Well, it was an incredible platform from which to tell the daily life story.
Yeah.
That was the story that you wanted to tell.
Totally. I mean, I think, you know, my mission in telling the stories of Iran was very much in line with the work that he was doing around the world, and the fact that he and his production company recognized that in me, in the work that I was doing, meant so much to me, and always will.
So I'm going to fast forward through the 500 and many, many days.
Mm-hmm.
How did the release come about? How did you get out?
So about 4 months into my imprisonment, the Obama administration decided that they would open up a channel of direct negotiations on the issue of American prisoners being held in Iran and Iranian prisoners being held in the U.S., of which there were several and still are. And they tasked Brett McGurk, who was Obama's envoy on the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, to do these negotiations with the Iranian interlocutors separate from the nuclear negotiations. So it was a 14-month process that culminated on the day of my release. And that wasn't something that me or anybody else knew about.
Just you woke up one morning and this was the day you're out?
I mean, you know, I realized that the day that I got out wasn't going to be, you know, like in a movie where they just say, you know, 62, that was my number, right? 62, you know, pack your bags, you're going home. I knew it wasn't going to be like that. I mean, it was much more treacherous and fraught. And I hope people read about it, because, you know, recounting that part of the book is still hard for me, because my blood pressure just goes up and up because it almost didn't happen. But, you know, the notion, the understanding that the American government had implemented a quest to bring me home, and that my wife was part and parcel of that plan from the very beginning, has helped to wash away some of the frustration of being held for so long.
How is she? How's your wife?
She's doing well. I mean, I think that it's always a mixed bag when you start a new life in a new place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think both of us, if we had our druthers, would still be living a life where we could come and go from Iran. Now, the Iranian government has made that impossible.
And you're banned, right?
I mean, there's no official ban. Mm-hmm. I think it's like a Roach Motel. I mean, I could go back, but I probably wouldn't be let out.
Roach Motel.
You know, I think for her it's much more difficult because it's where she grew up. That's where she, you know, was educated, where she lived her life. You know, most of her relations are there. And, you know, she was traded away by her home government. And that is not a fate that anybody should have to deal with.
It's a betrayal, really.
It's an incredible betrayal. I mean, it's unfortunately, it's something that's happened to a lot of Iranians over the years.
Yeah. You were a bit of an outlier in Iran, as you wrote, Uncensored. A lot of the people that are in Iran tend to be censored. And I don't know what their actual motivation is, but it sounds like just being a journalist was what put the target on you. What would you like to say about the power of freedom of speech in the United States?
I think freedom of speech and our right to our expression in any circumstances is something that we obviously take for granted. It's been tested many times in recent years. But it's also been taken advantage of in nefarious ways. And I would hope that as Americans, we spend more time trying to understand why this right is our most sacred right. Right? It's the one that everybody points to as a defining principle of our country. At the moment, you know, we have a president who takes aim at journalists, claims that we're the enemy of the people. That doesn't help anybody anywhere. And it certainly makes our jobs not only more difficult, more dangerous. And I think for decades on this question of press freedom, we've been the guiding light around the world. We're not anymore. And I'd like to see us get back to that.
Well, Jason Rezaian, thanks so much for coming to Southwest Florida and for taking the time to talk with me today.
It's a great pleasure.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
When we return, we're going to listen back to a conversation WGCU's Mike Kenyre had about the Southwest Florida Community Foundation's new collaboratory in downtown Fort Myers. It's a model of collaboration and integration built in a building that used to be a symbol of separation and segregation. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.